once again blasts U.S. sanctions against the country, saying economic terrorism amid a pandemic is a crime against humanity. The U.S. announces a new package of military aid for Ukraine, a move expected to provoke Russia's anger ahead of a summit between the U.S. and Russian presidents. And the U.N. Special Rapporteur expresses concern about reports of the torture of five imprisoned human rights activists in the United Arab Emirates. Thanks for joining us. Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says Washington's continued sanctions against the Islamic Republic amid the coronavirus pandemic amounts to crime against humanity. Araghchi, in a tweet, also said that Washington, with its economic terrorism, keeps trying to inflict suffering and hardships on Iranians. He said the former U.S. President Donald Trump is no longer in office, but his illegal and brutal sanctions remain in place. Remarks came as the U.S. has not yet removed the sanctions imposed on Iran by Trump. Washington has even refused to remove sanctions on the import of medical equipment and medicines at a time when Iran, like most other countries, is struck by the COVID-19 pandemic. With less than a week to Iran's presidential election, the candidates are trying hard to appeal to around 16 million potential voters. Let's go over to our election studio to see what the contenders had to say.
Welcome to another edition of Election Special. Thank you for joining us. With just a week to go before Iran's presidential election, candidates are outlining their plans in an effort to secure enough votes to win the race for the country's top executive post. The candidates' plans range from pledging more jobs to creating an environment conducive to bring significant changes to the country's banking system. Let's take a look at some of those plans. Iran's presidential candidate, Abdul Nasser Hemati, has criticized some limitations that have been put on women and young people as meaningless. He said the youth are not happy with the current situation because there is too much pressure on them. Hemati said some fundamental changes are needed, adding that he has plans to do so in order to witness more active presence of the young people in the social and economic fields. The presidential hopeful also slammed the sanctions imposed on Iran as cruel that have affected people's livelihoods. Here's more.
People's livelihoods have been affected by cruel sanctions and unfortunately by actions of some groups that always undermine the measures. Sanctions have inured heavy losses and disrupted our sources of income. Some people belittle FATF, but I think it is very important. We, along with one or two countries, have been exempted from having financial transactions with the rest of the world. The whole world is based on banking and financial transactions. Our exports have been disrupted, and our transaction costs have increased too much. All these are impacting the country's economy to a great extent.
Ebrahim Raisi says producing as many as 2 million cars in 1 year is feasible. Raisi says he opposes monopoly in car industry, adding that this has become an issue and concern amongst people and has to be tackled as soon as possible. The presidential candidate said his future administration will strive to control prices of cars and at the same time boost their quality. He said his government will take measures to make Iran's car industry totally independent. Alireza Zalkani says Iran's banking system has been subject to some mismanagement, especially during the current administration. The banking system is literally out of work, and it is imposing its problems on the country, he said. Zalkani added he would integrate the country's banking system if elected president. Regarding women, the 55-year-old candidate pledged to provide necessary support for women so that they can play their role in education and training the country's new generation. Let's take a listen.
The Islamic Revolution created opportunities that helped women play important roles in society. It basically brought up a new approach. There's a big difference between how women are now viewed in Iran and the approach to them in Western states. The West views everything and everyone based on economic principles, and that includes women. But from the viewpoint of Islam, Culture is the main principle of society, economy, and politics. So a culture-based society makes women the most important factor in education and training of their children. This also highlights the importance of women in playing a leading and pivotal role in families. That's why women need more support to have an active role.
All right, let's move on to the next presidential candidate, Saeed Jalili. He says he will create as many as 4 million jobs if elected. The 55-year-old candidate says one of the country's major issues is unemployment, adding that a young person spends 10 years of his life studying, but he struggles to find a job after being graduated. Jalili said his future administration has multiple plans to tackle unemployment. Jalili, who has also served as the country's top nuclear negotiator, said he also plans to address industry, tourism, and fishing issues. Iran's presidential hopeful, Mohsen Rezaei, says he will make policy to deal with neighboring countries seriously if elected to office. He said there are differences in ideas with neighbors that should be resolved. Rezaei said his government will be pioneer in resolving issues depending on the will of the neighboring countries. The presidential candidate also said he would activate the national economy regardless of the outcome of Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear deal.
Our government will remain committed to all international obligations. The JCPOA is an international commitment that was violated by the U.S., but we will remain committed to the deal. It is important to force the U.S. to fulfill its commitments. We will pursue right diplomacy, but we will not be waiting for any agreement in Vienna. By reactivating national economy, we will minimize our independence on the U.S. as much as possible. They should feel that the more time they waste, the more they will lose. We will start boosting our national production, and they are the ones who would be following us.
Another candidate is Mohsen Mehralizadeh. He says he is against monopoly regarding car production. He also says he is against monopoly in importing cars from other countries. Mehralizadeh says he has plans to improve the country's national car industry, which dates back to some 60 years ago. The 64-year-old candidate says he will put tariffs on imported cars in an effort to control the market and manage prices. He also said he will pursue the policy of making the car market a competitive one so the domestic car industry can flourish. Now, last but not least, presidential candidate Amir Hossein Qazizadeh Hashemi. Addressing reporters on Friday, Qazizadeh Hashemi said the election fever is starting to run high as people are weighing up who can run the country for the next 4 years. He expressed hope that the turnout will be huge on the election day. On Thursday, he briefly outlined his plans for different provinces. He said each city needs to be able to offer services similar to those being offered in the capital. Qazizadeh Hashemi also made some comments regarding diplomacy, saying that the foreign policy must be mainly focused on the economy. Here's more.
It is very important for the governments to have plans for each province, aside from those for the country as a whole. My government's provincial plans include assigning greater responsibilities to local governors. We have a model based on which all of our cities will be similar to Tehran, and therefore people would not need to travel to the capital for particular services. We also want diplomacy for the economy and nothing else. The foreign ministry is most valuable to us when it manages to pave the way for economic exchanges with other countries.
Iran's presidential candidates have outlined their plans ahead of the vote. This as people are weighing up who can be the most qualified candidate to run the country in the next 4 years. At the moment, what seems to be the issue of very high significance for people is the candidate's foreign policy agenda. We are going to take a look at how the presidential hopefuls are planning to deal with the rest of the world. Former central bank governor of Iran, Abdel Nasser Hemati, he says he would work to boost Iran's foreign policy, which he says will be based on de-escalation of tensions. Hemati has also vowed to get the Financial Action Task Force, or FATF, passed in the Expediency Council if elected president. Let's move on. Mohsen Mehralizadeh, who previously served as Iran's vice president, says boosting bilateral and multilateral relations with Iran's neighbors is part of his agenda. The 64-year-old candidate says boosting Iran's economy is possible amid sanctions. He has called for a development-oriented foreign policy. Here's more.
Development-oriented foreign policy will be one of the priorities of my government. This means that the foreign policy will focus on contributing to economic policies and lead to an increase in domestic production and end to any hurdles in the way of exports. We may have minor problems with some neighboring countries, but we should mend ties for the sake of domestic economic development.
Another contender in Iran's presidential race is Saeed Jalili. He has served as Iran's top nuclear negotiator before. The 55-year-old says his foreign policy approach mainly focuses on anti-Iran sanctions. Jalili says lifting sanctions, circumventing the measures, and rendering them ineffective for good are issues to be addressed. Now next, Ebrahim Raisi. He is another candidate running for presidency. He has outlined his foreign policy agenda, saying his plans are based on principles such as honor, wisdom, and expediency set out by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Raisi says four major points his administration will try to address include the Iran nuclear deal or the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Iran's regional influence, economic diplomacy, and last but not least, targeted foreign relations. He also says he intends to have better interaction with the world. Let's take a listen.
With your help and through strong diplomacy, we can establish good relations with the regional countries and raise the volume of our exports to the neighbors to the best level. We believe in interactions with the entire world in order to solve the country's economic issues, but the regional countries should be a priority.
Another candidate running for the top executive post is Amir Hossein Ghazizadeh Hashim. He says the main focus of his government will be to establish and boost trade relations with African and Latin American countries. He also says his administration will make the best use of foreign assets to improve the economy. Another presidential hopeful, Mohsen Rezaei, has stressed the need to strengthen ties with Iran's immediate neighbors and other regional countries in order to improve the economy. The presidential candidate has vowed to work hard for democratic institutions and invoke optimism among people that their votes count. Stick listening.
We will adopt a regional diplomacy, and our foreign policy will focus more on regional countries. Foreign policy is successful if it boosts Iran's economy and increases Iranians' annual income.
Yet another candidate in the race is Alireza Zakani. He is currently serving as a member of Iranian parliament. He says foreign policy is the fourth axis of his plan. Zakani says he wants to turn Iran into a role model for the region. The 56-year-old candidate says foreign policy must be adopted to bring dignity, adding that it is also very important to use the capacity of Iranians abroad.
In future foreign policy, you will see that equations will quickly change. As part of active smart diplomacy, the capacities of the region, the neighbors, the resistance front, and the emerging powers can be used while paying special attention to ties with the East, besides properly dealing with the West.
Now, let's go over to the debates. The candidates are set to take part in the third and final presidential debate on June the 12th. They, like the previous debates, will answer questions in a three-hour session to outline their plan. Well, that's a wrap for now. Thanks for tuning in.
Welcome back. The U.S. has announced a new package of military assistance for Ukraine. The $150 million worth of aid includes radar systems, drones, and secure communications equipment. The U.S. Defense Department says that it is in addition to the $125 million in assistance announced in March. According to a Pentagon spokesman, the military shipment is aimed at helping Ukraine preserve its territorial integrity. The U.S. has provided more than $2.5 billion in security assistance to Ukraine since the year 2014. That is when a conflict flared up in eastern Ukraine, where pro-Russian forces have declared independence. The new aid comes ahead of a meeting between the U.S. President Joe Biden and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin in Switzerland next week. Independent political analyst Gilbert Doctorow says that some officials in the Pentagon seek to limit the results of Biden's meeting with Putin by announcing the military package to Ukraine.
Surely, within the Pentagon, just as in other leading institutions in the United States, opinions are divided about Russia and how to best handle it. In the case of this announcement, it's clear that one side of the Pentagon, or certain officials within the Pentagon, are looking to limit the results of the summit, to hinder the summit, to present obstacles to Joe Biden in his outreach to President Putin. At the same time, it is my own view that other forces within the Pentagon have been among the leading influences pushing Biden to hold this summit so early in his presidency. It is in timing, it is not much different from what preceding presidents have done, but in the case of Biden, considering his hostility to the Russians and to President Putin in particular, it is remarkable that at this stage, relatively early in his presidency, he has chosen to meet with the Russian president. The reality is that Russia has become the single strongest strategic threat to the United States military position. And it has, thanks to new weapon systems that were announced by President Putin 3 years ago and which have been implemented since.
A United Nations expert has called on the United Arab Emirates to immediately release 5 imprisoned human rights activists. Mary Lawler described their sentences as excessively severe. The 5 activists are part of a group of 94 lawyers, human rights defenders, and academics who were sentenced to 10 years in prison in July 2013 for allegedly plotting to overthrow the UAE regime. Lawler expressed concern that they have been subjected to torture by being held in solitary confinement for long periods. She said that their right to a fair trial also have been violated, as they were denied or given limited access to legal counsel. The UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights Defenders stressed that they should have never been detained in the first place for legitimately exercising the freedoms. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Blessed birthday of the munificent lady. In the name of God, the all-merciful, the all-compassionate. Salam, dear listeners, and heartiest felicitations to you on a very special day. Iran and the Iranian people are celebrating the Daughter's Day today in honor of one of the most virtuous daughters of Eve, the mother of mankind, but, of course, with full observation of the social distancing and other hygienic measures advised by medics and health experts in view of the coronavirus pandemic. She is none other than our Blessed Lady of Qom, Hazrat Fatima, peace upon her, the daughter of Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, the seventh infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. She was born in the Prophet's city, Medina, in 173 AH, corresponding to 789 AD, on the first of the month of Dhul-Qa'dah, to Lady Najme, peace upon her, the mother of her consanguineous eldest brother, Imam Reza, peace upon him. This means divine providence had chosen for her mother the mother of an infallible Imam, which is indeed a highest honor, since the mothers of the infallibles are ladies of impeccable faith and piety, with no infidel or wayward person among their ancestors. Known popularly as Ma'sume or the Innocent, the holy shrine of the lady whose birthday we are celebrating today reposes in eternal peace in the city of Qom, which today is the center of a spreading of Islamic teachings worldwide. Qom is the second most blessed spot on the soil of Iran after Mashhad in Khorasan, where her brother, Imam Reza, peace upon him, reposes in eternal peace, and hence a site of pilgrimage for not just Iranians, but for the followers of the Ahlul Bayt from all over the world. Before we present you a special feature in this regard, here is a passage of ziyarat, or standard form of salutation, prescribed for her immaculate ancestress, the noblest lady of all time, the Prophet's daughter, Hazrat Fatimatu Zahra, peace upon her. Peace upon you, O the carefully examined, tried and measured by him who created you. O found you in your test, cool and compact, steady and stable. I tell the truth about you, calm and quiet. With self-control and composure, you put up with all that which your father and his wasi came across. Blessings of Allah be upon them. Indeed, Fatima Masume, peace upon her, was a worthy descendant of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, the infallible mother of the leaders of the youth of paradise, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, peace upon them. She spent the first 6 years of her life with her father, who was often subjected to bouts of imprisonment by the Abbasid regime. He instilled in her knowledge and virtues to such an extent that, at a tender age of 6 years, she was able to answer complicated jurisprudential questions. An example of her knowledge and outstanding merits is the famous incident when her father remarked, "Fadaha Buha," which means, "May her father be her sacrifice." It happened that a group of pilgrims from Iran had called at the threshold of Ahlul Bayt in Medina for answers to their queries, unaware that Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, was away on a journey. They were, however, not sent away empty-handed, for an attendant asked for their papers, saying the seventh Imam's little daughter could provide the answers To their surprise, the replies which they received from the little girl were not just satisfactory, but beyond whatever they could comprehend. During their return journey to Iran, they happened to meet the seventh imam, and when they showed him the answers given by his little daughter, he confirmed these facts with a smile on his face, an expression of gratitude to God Almighty for having blessed him with such a virtuous daughter. Fatima Masume, peace upon her, is also the source of several narrations from the Imams and her ancestor, the Prophet, and is often called Aleme, or Most Learned Lady. For this reason, she was respected in her lifetime and continues to be revered to this day with pilgrims to her holy shrine, reciting, O Fatima, intercede for me for the reward of paradise, for indeed you have with Allah a lofty status. She was only 10 years old when her father, Imam Kazem, peace upon him, was martyred in Baghdad in the prison of the tyrant Harun al-Rashid through a dose of fatal poison. Therefore, she grew under the care of her dear brother, Imam Reza, peace upon him, and years later, when he was forced to leave Medina and taken to distant Khorasan to the court of the crafty Caliph Ma'mun in the city of Marv, in what is currently the Republic of Turkmenistan, the faithful sister decided to visit him. On the way near Save, a distance of some 120 kilometers from modern Tehran, her caravan was attacked by miscreants affiliated to the regime, as a result of which many of her entourage, including her brothers, attained martyrdom, while she suffered injuries. She turned towards Qom, where the followers of the Ahlul Bayt warmly received her. Here, following a brief sojourn of 17 days, her soul flew to the ethereal heaven, making Qom the stairway of paradise. Masume, peace upon her, who had remained unmarried throughout her 28-year life, since no man of her age was worthy of her immaculate hand, similar to the case of the Virgin Mary, has thus left a lasting legacy. She is known as Karimatul Ahlul Bayt, or the most munificent lady of the Prophet's household. Her nephew, Imam Jawad, peace upon him, has said, whoever visits her tomb aware of her status, paradise is the reward. Indeed, throughout the past millennium and two centuries, people have flocked to her shrine, including ulema, jurisprudents, and philosophers, such as the famous sage of the Safavid era, Sadruddin Shirazi, popularly known as Mullah Sadra, who has said that whenever he came across a complicated question, his visit to the shrine of Masume would unravel the mysteries and enlighten his mind. No doubt, Qom is today the world center for the genuine teachings of Islam, and students from all over the globe come to this Iranian city to learn Islamic sciences in the shadows of the sprawling mausoleum of Hazrat Masume, peace upon her. Since it is the will of Almighty Creator that the grave in Medina of the Prophet's daughter, the infallible Fatimatu Zahra, peace upon her, remain concealed till the reappearance of the Prophet's 12th and last successor, Imam Mahdi, peace upon him, and the dawn of the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. It is Qum and the shrine of Fatima Masume, peace upon her, that bestows the same rewards on the pilgrims who are desirous of paying homage to the Prophet's daughter. Numerous miracles have taken place at the shrine of Hazrat Masume, and many persons have been cured of fatal diseases as confirmed by medics who earlier had lost hope in the health of the patients. These miraculous powers, coupled with the spiritual aura of the shrine, have made many non-Muslim visitors, including those from Europe, America, and Africa, embrace the truth of Islam. It is worth noting that the late prominent scholar and researcher, Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Shahabuddin Marashi, used to be the first person to perform the pilgrimage at the shrine of this noble lady every morning for 60 years. In the early hours of the day, when it was still dark, he would wait outside her shrine for the doors to be opened. Several hadith from the Prophet have also been narrated by Hazrat Masume, peace upon her, through a chain of authorities whose credentials are beyond any question. No doubt, her grandfather, Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace upon him, the sixth infallible heir of the Prophet, had predicted about her half a century before her birth and given tidings to the faithful about her resting place, Qum, where today an exclusive seminary for higher education function for ladies from Iran and abroad. Once again, we congratulate our dear listeners on the blessed birthday of Hazrat Masume, peace upon her, which is celebrated as Daughter's Day in the Islamic Republic of Iran in order to instill the qualities of virtue, ethics, and good manners into the young female generation. It is also worth noting that beginning from the 1st of Dhulqa'dah till the 11th of Dhulqa'dah, which is the birth anniversary of Imam Reza, peace upon him, this period is celebrated as Dahiye Karamat, or 10 days of munificence, in honor of these two immaculate brother and sister. We thus end this brief radio program with a phrase from her ziyarat, which is self-explanatory. Peace upon you, O daughter of Musa, son of Jafar. The mercy and blessing of Allah be upon you. Peace upon you. And may God ensure cognition between us and you in paradise. Raise us on the day of resurrection in your company. Bring us to your Prophet's fountain of Kothar, and quench our thirst through the goblet of your ancestor, by the hand of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him.
the debate.
Britain and the European Union have failed to agree on any solutions to ease post-Brexit trade with Northern Ireland and exchange threats in a standoff that could cloud the G7 international summit over the weekend. Since Britain completed its arduous exit from the EU late last year, its relations with Brussels have sunk, with each side accusing the other of bad faith over a part of their Brexit deal that covers goods movements to Northern Ireland. Britain says that the ball is very much in the EU's court with regards to the implementation of the protocol. The EU says its patience with the UK is running out and threatened trade sanctions if London unilaterally broke its promises. Well, we're now joined by our correspondent, Amina Taylor, who's with us from the British capital, London, with more on that. Amina?
Claudia, it was always going to be this way, wasn't it? Boris Johnson and his team essentially kicked a fundamental aspect of post-Brexit agreements into the long grass. And now I'm afraid those chickens are coming home to roost, because Joe Biden, the US president, is very much a man whose Irish roots have been one of the things that has propped up his rise through US politics. And for so many people in Ireland, they feel that this is a betrayal. They feel this is a complete betrayal of everything that was previously negotiated, and something that London decided that it didn't really like how it looked, so it was going to just drop a new deal after they had agreed with the EU.
All right, thanks a lot, Amina. Taylor joining us from the British capital, London. We're now joined by senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, who's with us from New York. Mr. Williams, welcome to the program. Why have the Tories changed their tune on the Northern Ireland protocol?
Mostly, I think, because they've only just discovered what it all entails. The whole Brexit deal was rushed through by Boris Johnson for internal advantage, so he could become the leadership, so he could become the leader of the Conservative Party. So he didn't really care about the details. He hasn't looked at the details. They didn't have contingency plans. So they've really painted themselves into a corner. They had a Northern Ireland agreement, which was the Good Friday Agreement, which binding international agreement, which they've signed on to. And the terms that they've agreed for the to get the Brexit deal rushed through, they just contravene it straightforward. There's no way he can square the circle to everyone's satisfaction. He can either isolate his allies in amongst the unionists in Northern Ireland by imposing a serious barrier against them, or he's got to reintroduce the Irish border, the Northern Irish Republic of Ireland border again, which contravenes his pledges to the EU and to Joe Biden, it would appear. So, I mean, really, he's painted himself into a corner, and no amount of his usual gymnastics and cavortings can get him out of it. I really cannot see the end result of this, because there's no solution that everyone will find acceptable. He's got a virtual tariff war, so goods going through Northern Ireland on the way to Ireland will have to face a real customs barrier in one way or another, whether it's actually there or not, a virtual customs barrier. They have to pay tariffs, and they have to abide by the laws of the European Union and the treaties. The utter absurdity of this, which your readers will have missed, I presume, is the sausage war. That, you know, Ireland is big on pork products and sausages, and there's now the issue of whether supermarket sausages made in Britain can be exported to Northern Ireland, because Britain has also pulled out of all the health and safety regulations that the European Union had. And the European Union says, quite rightly, that if you want to import foodstuffs into the European Union, they have to meet our standards. So Boris Johnson has blithely said, no, that's why we left the European Union. We don't want to abide by European standards. And so he's yet himself, you know, yet another corner to paint himself into. This is a multi-sided room with many corners, and he's painted himself into all of them.
Indeed. Journalist and political commentator Saeed Mohsen Abbas is joining us now on tonight's debate from London. Mr. Abbas, welcome to the program. Boris Johnson He claims that the EU's demands for checks on goods moving between Great Britain and Northern Ireland are too inconvenient and are disrupting trade. Well, they weren't imposed on Britain. It was an agreement that was negotiated. Why does London not want to honor its own handiwork?
Because London didn't think about the consequences of Brexit. The people who were pushing for this exit did it in the most bizarre, most rash manner. Even the actual announcing of the whole process of having a referendum, which seemed needless in the first place, to be fair, it seemed to be something more convenient for the Tory party at that time than the nation itself, was quite a ridiculous notion. And then, of course, the way that it was rushed through, the lack of information, the lies, the downright extra lies, and the outright lies were all manifested. I mean, look, they said that Brexit would help the country experience immediate cost savings. Well, that's going to be pretty dubious. I mean, they said that it was because they were paying £13.1 billion in membership dues, and et cetera. So, but they didn't mention what they got out of the EU at that time, and most of the public remained ignorant of that. They said Brexit would shift the emphasis of trade for Britain. But again, you see already now that they're moaning and groaning, and their much-wanted exercises in trying to create agreements outside of the EU with the rest of the world aren't going particularly famously. It's an awfully difficult task to renegotiate all these agreements that were rolled into one. And I think, you know, again, this idea of establishing the sovereignty of Britain was very powerful. It was a very emotive and emotional message at the time, on the back of which Boris and his cohort, who were pushing for this premature exit, I would say, actually used the whole British nationalism, or the English nationalism, probably more to the point, because Scotland doesn't seem that keen on this business of Brexit. And we're seeing that Northern Ireland was always going to be the problem, the sting in the tail, if you like, because, of course, it's got the connections with Ireland itself, and that becomes an open door for all sorts of, of course, contradictions, which they're now beginning to uncover. I think the fact that Biden has weighed in and America has weighed in shows where they are pushing the Brits towards. I mean, of course, if they don't go with the Biden scenario, then they're arguably going to suffer with their main card that they were using as a way of sort of balancing the books from the trade they'd lose with the EU, i.e. America, and its vast market where they were supposed to go and push their exports, etc. Well, after what Biden has said, it's quite clear that he's not terribly happy, and America is not terribly happy in giving Britain a carte blanche. So there's been a lot of failures, and I could go on with all the other lies. You know, they said Brexit would reduce the issues with forced immigration associated with the EU. Well, again, another fact that is almost impossible for them to deal with, that Britain can't do without immigrant workers to do the low-end jobs, you know, the fruit pickers, the late-night hotel porters and cleaners, and the people who will do all the jobs which the British public or the British citizenry will leave till the last on their list. So, of course, these are just some of the, if you like, lies and outright sort of foolishness, which right. Is now gradually going to get exposed.
Let's go back to Ian Williams in New York. Ian, the EU is threatening trade sanctions if Johnson unilaterally breaks promises that he made relating to Northern Ireland. If this row escalates any further, are we looking at the possibility of a full-blown trade war, in your opinion?
I think it's very possible. The Europeans, quite understandably, have very little patience for Britain at the moment. They have even less patience for Boris Johnson and his posturings. And, you know, they really see, you know, that they're not being unreasonable. They're asking that they, you know, the agreements as they agreed be actually implemented. You know, it's interesting that one of the reasons why Britain wanted to opt out of European standards is so that they could have a trade deal with America that that encompasses Trump's insistence that they allow polluted, effectively hormone-ridden, bleached American meat products into Britain. That was one of the deals. So he opted out of Europe so they could get that, and now he finds that British sausages, heaven help us, are barred from Northern Ireland. And issue after issue, they just did not think through. They did it on the spur to get a momentary political advantage, to make Boris Johnson the leader of the Conservative Party and the Prime Minister. And over and over, they didn't think about the implications for the union with Scotland. They didn't think about the implications of the Northern Ireland issue. They didn't think about the implications of the US in the end. Because, you know, Britain still pretends it has a special relationship with the US. But the special relationship is a completely subordinate, servile one. And you know, the US, it finds Britain very useful. It's a sort of diplomatic sepoy who does what the Americans want quite often. But I mean, the Americans don't need Britain in a serious way, but Britain seriously needs America if it's to maintain its standing in the world. It's much vaunted nuclear deterrent is basically borrowed from the Americans. It's on a lease. They're renting it from the Americans. They have to give it back if the Americans don't renew it, or the Americans don't want to help them renew the Trident. So that's Britain's pretensions as a nuclear power. And, I mean, that's what we're all about in many ways. It's about posturing and position, and it's the hanging on by Boris Johnson's fingernails to the illusion that Britain, well, it is a big power, but not a major power. And he's going to fall flat on his face in the mud, or in the Irish Sea at least, at this one.
All right, Sayed Mohsen Abbas, UK's, rather the UK, it says that we can work something out and all is not lost. EU's negotiators, they said the recent talks were not good at all. How do you explain this heavy contrast in tone?
Well, clearly somebody's being dishonest. I rather suspect it's the British, because the EU has been very robust and very straightforward in what it's demanded and wanted. Eventually, they seem to bundle through some kind of agreement over the line. Even that looked very, very dubious at one point. And now we're going backwards yet again. It's sometimes one wonders whoever is constructing this, whether they actually want, from the British policymaking side, whether they actually want this chaos to continue. Of course, you've got COVID, you've had the collapse of the economy, which will quietly begin to manifest in real terms for the hardship on people. And on top of that, you've got Brexit, where, you know, the possibility of new jobs, etc., of course, was a big issue that was on the table at the time. You know, there were estimates that 3 million jobs in Britain were connected to trade policies, procedures or activities at that time, and separating from Europe. Risked and created a risk where these employment opportunities would be lost. And that's exactly still the case, even more so now, given that COVID-19 has affected the economy even more. You know, they said that, of course, Brexit would improve border security. Another nonsense. I mean, there was no real way that you could stop the flow of people and the movement if you're continuing with wars in the Middle East, for instance, as Britain partakes very, very vigorously in across Syria, Afghanistan, and various other places where they've been, of course, triggering the migrant crisis into Europe. So, you know, on the one hand, you're promising that Brexit will improve all this border security, reduce the migrants' population, but yet you're continuing to fuel war for the sake of your, again, economic interests abroad. So, you know, again, there were these kind of paradoxes. And you know, they also talked about how it would, give British bureaucracy freedom, you know, sovereignty and freedom of the bureaucracy. Well, the fact is that the City of London, the Corporation of London here, runs most of our economic trajectory and direction, I would say, behind in the corridors of power. Westminster has almost very little say when it comes to some of these economic realities. And again, I think that if you're going to be saying, oh, we're not going to be controlled by the European technocrats and the bureaucrats, but we're going to do it from Westminster, that's again a kind of fallacy, because Britain is in debt, is getting increasingly more and more in debt. Who's it in debt to? Most of the guys who are down there in the City of London, the corporate banksters and whatever networks they have around them. And it's those folks that actually ultimately underwrite Britain in one shape or form economically, you know, 20-30% of the GDP on paper is generated by that square mile in London. So they are a factor which never gets really drawn into these discussions, and they were notably very mute on Brexit. So there are many factors which, you know, prove the lie that Boris and the Tory government pushed through in terms of this this fiasco of Brexit.
There are many factors indeed. Ian Williams, France threatens to veto any changes to the Brexit deal. The French President Emmanuel Macron, he lambasted the UK for seeking to renegotiate the NI protocol only months after agreeing to it. Macron said nothing is renegotiable and everything should be applied. That's a lot of opposition to the UK's behavior. Unpack Macron's comments for us, please.
It's self-evident. They spent a lot of time negotiating a deal that the British asked for. Remember, the British left. They weren't thrown out. They left despite pleas from people in Europe that they shouldn't. They left. They were offered. They could have taken longer to negotiate and talk around the deals, but they spent 2 years basically spinning wheels and not really doing much in the way of negotiation. Because this is it's the ineptitude of this. The Conservative Party at least used to pretend to be competent. Competent but callous. I mean, these are incompetent and callous. They didn't factor in all of these details. And we saw that over the COVID as well. I mean, you know, the biggest death rate in the world, or the highest death rate in the world, massive close downs. And it was all because the buffoon in chief was busily pretending that things didn't really happen. He sat there with his hands, you know, like three wise monkeys in one. Do no evil, hear no evil, see no evil. He didn't speak a lot of evil, though. But mostly he was the epitome of callous incompetence. And he still is. And, you know, if it's the real tragedy of Britain, there's no serious opposition to this as well. It's worth mentioning, by the way, that the Labour Party has never organised in Northern Ireland, and actually it's sort of one of its bedrock policies has always been in favour of a united Ireland, with Northern Ireland being separate from Britain. So they're in a bit of a dichotomy here as well. So, you know, the union was a Conservative project. The Conservative Party used to be called the Conservative and Unionist Party. The union with Northern Ireland was their biggest strength. It was one of the reasons they got votes in places like Scotland and in the old days in Liverpool, because they were the Conservative and Unionist Party. And, you know, they've thrown away their historical stuff on this, and they're about to throw away Northern Ireland, it would appear. Scotland, of course, they've managed to alienate almost completely. It's a moot point how long it will last. This is a really tragically disastrous government for Britain, whichever side of the political spectrum you're on. You know, Britain is being dismembered politically, economically, and, you know, diplomatically. And it's a self-inflicted wound.
Mohsen Abbas, the EU has set all Brexit border checks on food, including chilled meats. Entering Northern Ireland from Great Britain would be abolished if the UK signed up to a Swiss-style deal. The UK has already ruled out this option because it requires regulatory alignment with the EU. Now, even if it was temporary, why would Brussels put forth such a solution? The UK didn't go through Brexit just to sign up to EU law again.
Well, I think that they toyed around with the Norwegian model, and now this Swiss model gets talked about. But again, ultimately, what you've got to look at is the incompetence, as my colleague has said, of this establishment, the incompetence actually of the civil service and the background teams that have been advising as well, I would say. I think it seems to be a comedy of errors all the way down the line. And whatever way they try to get out of it, the fact is that you've got a whole list of cons that Brexit was bound to bring in, you know, the elimination of protection of equal pay, maternity leaves and safe workplaces, that's all on the line, you know, all those equal rights for women, the human rights laws, etc. That's also going to be, you know, a lot of it's going to be going down the drain. You know, Brexit, you know, changing the perspective of Britain being the gateway to Europe. You know, how that was one thing which, you know, also was mooted. One of the reasons Britain decided to avoid the Eurozone, the strength of its currency was higher, you know. But again, those are delusions, because once your business isn't going well and you've got no investment coming in, your trade is going down, then, of course, the value of your own currency is going to drop and the economics will start falling all around you. Of course, you know, the labor shortage that I briefly mentioned would kick in, because I know that there are lots of immigrants who from Poland, certainly the East European immigrants, there's been a massive exodus in I think almost some quotes I've had are up to a million plus immigrant workers have already given up on Britain because they just don't see the future here. And these were people who were doing work which was obviously building the economy of Britain, you know. You know, again, also the nonsense around breaking off with such a massive conglomerate of European nations is bound to impact the intelligence the intelligence networks,
sure.
You know, the sharing of information which was there on the cards, that's all going to be much, much more difficult to sort of access. They're not going to be as freely giving in
okay.
that regard and make it weaker as well. Many, many other things I can say that the foreign direct investments in Britain that are being received, they will suffer. The list is endless in terms of the disasters that Brexit is very, very likely to bring in. It hasn't even started yet, I'd say. The Northern Ireland issue is just the tip of the iceberg.
Okay, thanks a lot, Mr. Abbo. Sorry to jump in there. We're fresh out of time for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guest, journalist and political commentator, Saeed Mohsen Abbas, joining us from London. Also, thanks to senior analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus, Mr. Ian Williams, speaking to us from New York. Also, special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم dear listeners. Welcome to another program of Islamic upbringing, and you're listening to IRIB English Radio. We talked about joining the world and righteousness and teaching that to a child in our previous programs with Brother Abdullah Al-Musawi, who is fortunately with us in this program. Also, salam alaikum, brother Abdullah Musawi.
Wa alaikum assalam.